Look, the film that opens it last year was Café Society by Woody Allen, which was a very good opener because it was starry and it was about movies and it wasn't like his best film ever. So it's kind of, you know, that medium film is quite good. Look, I think they try and get a film because normally the opening night film's not in competition. So you can't have like the winner going on opening night. So they don't put the best film on the opening night. Otherwise, you know, never open with a showstopper. So that's kind of why. So it's a bit of a sort of cursed slot. We had the Da Vinci Code opening one year, which everyone was a bit very embarrassed about because it's rubbish and it shouldn't really be at Cannes. But it was a big international film, kind of half shot in Paris. So they try and kind of bring in like a certain aspect of cinema rather than give us a big heavy art house number or a big, you know, film from a country no one's heard of with stars that no one's heard of. They try and sort of, you know, up the ante and give it a bit of star glamour. And that's not always easy to combine that with sort of a good film that, say, the studios want you to have because it often gets a sort of real kind of, you know, attention focused on it because everyone wants to know about the opening night film, and it's not the best film. It can't really stand up to that kind of scrutiny. And the rest of the festival goes and opens, and then, you know, there are 100 films going on, so focus is not so quite sort of lasered and scrutinized as it is on that opening night film.
This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. Coming up, Pedro Almodovar butts heads at the Cannes Film Festival over whether streaming giants ought to be allowed to compete.
To be seen in not only 190 countries, but always to be seen in a big screen.
Meanwhile, at Warner Brothers, just how much of a box office disaster is Guy Ritchie's new film, King Arthur?
All right, where do you want me?
Bouncing on my knee. Where'd you think I want ya? Hands on the eel, stupid.
And later in the show, another king gets the epic revival treatment.
I'm going to ask the gentlemen of the press to come forward so that the audience may have the privilege of seeing them take the first photographs of Kong and his captors.
King Kong is bound for Broadway, but can the Australian production win over crowds in the Big Ape's hometown? That's all ahead on The Cinema Show on Monocle 24.
The honor is mine, you know, to be surrounded with this incredible cast of directors, actresses, actors, and musicians. No. It's impossible to be more lucky than I am now in this moment.
That was Pedro Almodovar speaking alongside his jury colleagues at the Cannes Film Festival this week. The Spanish filmmaker is this year's president, joining fellow members Paolo Sorrentino, Park Chan-wook, and Marin Arde, director of last year's competition favourite, Tony Erdmann.
Thank you so much. I'm very, very moved. Well, seeing films and making them has been for a long time the most important thing in my life. When I see a film I'm passionate about, I think it belongs to me, that it is a part of me, and I use it in my own films. All my films are steeped in the films that I have seen and that have moved me throughout my life. Now that this edition of the Cannes Film Festival is about to begin, I can only say that I hope that the 19 films in competition I'm going to see will not only leave a mark in my life, but also will feed me and inspire me somehow in my present and in the next movies that I will do.
During the jury's interview, Will Smith jokingly suggested that he was looking forward to planting a scandal at this year's festival. And while it might not be a scandal, a slight row did erupt over the merits of Netflix being involved in this year's event. Hello and welcome to The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. Jason Solomons is at the Cannes Film Festival for us this year. Jason, thanks for joining us. How did this whole Netflix debate begin?
Yeah, I mean, Cannes has been dominated by, you'd have thought the terrorist threat was the biggest threat to Cannes, because the increased security here with flower pots and airport style security and bomb checks and snipers on the roof of the Palais, would you believe? But actually the biggest threat to cinema here is from Netflix, which has dominated the early days of the festival. It dominated it before it arrived because it had secured two slots in competition here at Cannes. And then they realized that these films weren't supposed to be coming out in theaters in France because they're Netflix, right? So they come out on your computer. This annoyed all the distributors in France to a huge degree, to the point where Cannes then sort of said, look, next year, if you're going to be in competition in Cannes, you've got to kind of be sure that you're going to be in French theatres. That's the new rule. And Netflix went, well, you're just circling the wagons against us. It's ridiculous. So that row's been rumbling on. Then, of course, the head of the jury this year, Pedro Almodovar, comes out at his press conference and sort of says, basically hints that basically those two titles from Netflix, you know, he's not going to be voting for them. He thinks Netflix is kind of ruining the classic cinema kind of experience.
Absolutely. It's just to be seen in not only 190 countries, but always to be seen in a big screen.
And his mate, Will Smith, who's on the jury with him, although I'm sure the two of them never met before. That's what Cannes juries do. They cast these strange characters together. Will Smith, who's got a film coming out on Netflix in a couple of months' time, says, oh, well, hold on, Netflix in my family, the kids watch Netflix. It enables them to watch sort of Spanish language movies, foreign language movies that they wouldn't normally watch. And yeah, it's fine. And we still go to the theater for a treat.
In my home, Netflix has had absolutely no effect on what they go to the movie theater to watch. They go to the movie theater to be humbled in front of certain images, and there's other films that they prefer to watch at home, and there's really little to no cross.
Anyway, what it means is that Netflix is what everyone's been talking about, whether people like to talk about it or whether they're not talking about it, when Netflix is here to stay. And if Cannes wants another 70 years of cinema, because this is its 70th birthday, it needs to sort out that route very quickly, as far as I can see.
So, I mean, it sort of feels as though both of the people involved here, Pedro and Will, have both got vested interests in whatever their position is on this particular row. But, I mean, when we're talking about Cannes, it's not really intended as this sort of beacon of cinema accessibility around the world, is it? It does have this sort of highbrow reputation. It sort of attracts the kind of films that aren't going to make huge amounts of money at the box office, but they are going to be absolute quality cinema, and you know that you can go along to see a Cannes contender and it will take you on an interesting journey, not your typical big multiplex popcorn fare. Is Netflix perhaps, you know, venturing down the wrong path on this?
Well, I think they're right. I mean, it's interesting that they're in competition, which I haven't seen these films yet. Of course, they haven't played in competition, but I'm assuming that they're of a sufficient quality to be sort of considered by Cannes boss Thierry Frémaux for his competition. And then it was the sort of the platform of their delivery sort of is a sort of afterthought. So I assume they're good. So it's interesting that Netflix are making films that are good. You know, that's the main thing. Amazon are doing the same thing. That's, you know, it's interesting because they could just be going for big numbers. They never reveal their numbers, but they are kind of supporting quality cinema. So for us cinema fans and cinema filmmakers and actors and actresses who flock to these kind of Netflix things, you know, that's the marker of it. Is it any good? And that's all that counts, really. So that's why I'm saying that while Cannes wants to support the old kind of cinema as a temple, and Cannes itself is its high temple, you know, you're right, that they're not keeping the theatres going. Multiplexes are not built on what is shown in competition in Cannes at all.
Il y a deux ans, je rencontrais Ismaël.
Vous n'avez pas d'enfant?
J'ai aimé des hommes mariés.
Ah, bon, en ce moment, je suis célibataire, donc ça ne nous laisse pas beaucoup de chance, quoi.
A few people are disagreeing with that blanket statement. Ismail's Ghost was the opening film. Various reports that I've read have described it as, well, atrocious. Some have compared it to the notorious 2014 film Grace of Monaco, starring Nicole Kidman as Grace Kelly. One of the most notorious films to come out in recent years, I would suggest. I mean, was it really all that bad?
It's interesting that the Cannes opening slot, instead of 20 years ago or so when I first had to come in, was always this kind of big, kind of French prestigious, normally a costume drama that was really lumbering. It was never, no one expected the opening night film to be any good. And then Moulin Rouge kind of changed all that when that was selected to open the festival. And suddenly you had a great movie that everyone was talking about. And suddenly it became sort of a good slot to have again. But in the last couple of years, since you mentioned there, Grace of Monaco, things have kind of tailed off quite badly. The opening night movie is not such a great spot anymore. And to give it to Ishmael's Ghost this year, which was a very, very surprising sort of opening night number by French director Arnaud Desplechin. Now, it does star Marion Cotillard, big star. It does star Charlotte Gainsbourg, a big star. It stars Mathieu Almeric, who many people probably know as the kind of that paranoid Bond villain, Lucien Green from Quantum of Solace. But he's a sort of French staple. So, you know, it was seen to be supporting French cinema to have a French film opening the festival. And this was going to be a sort of a big one. It's about filmmaking as well. So they tend to like that to open the festival. Unfortunately, the film is complete nonsense. I mean, you're right, atrocious. It was indecipherable. It was about five ideas in one. Arnaud Desplechin, who I often like, is sometimes called the French Woody Allen. And here he's kind of got about five Woody Allen stories going at once. It's about a filmmaker who kind of has a kind of crisis when a ghost returns from his past, although she's not a ghost, it's Marion Cotillard, and it was his wife who he thought was dead. She now comes back, and that upsets his current relationship with Charlotte Gainsbourg. He has a nervous breakdown. He walks off set. His producer follows him off set. They end up kind of cooped up in a car trunk. He starts shooting him. I mean, complete nonsense. And then we have to see the film within a film that he's making, which looks terrible with Louis Garrel in it. We have to see a bit of that. So, I mean, I didn't really know what was going on. I get a feeling it was one of those films that tries to depict a nervous breakdown and a movie getting out of hand, you know, like 8.5, the Fellini's film. But it couldn't get the conundrum of how to depict that without falling apart itself. And it was one of those films that very quickly I wanted to stop, despite the fact that it features Marion Cotillard in the nude at one point, which I thought was a big, sort of quite a shocking kind of like big reveal for Marion. Everyone was like, oh, haven't seen that before. And, but it also features her doing a kind of extraordinarily weird rubbish dance to a Bob Dylan track. You know, like when Ralph Fiennes did it in that great little seaside film, the Italian one, when he did it to the Rolling Stones recently. And it was a funny dance. You can do sort of bad dancing funnily. I think she tries to do that, but it comes off just like, I think she's having a nervous breakdown. I think everyone's having a nervous breakdown in front of Ishmael's Goats. I mean, there was deafening silence. Normally here you get a boo or a clap, but just nothing. Everyone was like, what on earth was that?
Well, Jason, let's move along quickly. The high praise that Carol got, the Todd Haynes film, of course, in 2015, seems to be following up quite well with his new film. It's already attracting some Oscar chatter. Tell us about Wonderstruck.
Yeah, that's right. It was a very good debut for him, Carol, a very stylish 1950s lesbian romance with great clothes by Sandy Powell. Again, Sandy Powell is back with Todd Haynes. They did The Velvet Goldmine together and won an artistic award here on the Croisette in 1998, that glam rock drama. They combined to do another period piece that Todd Haynes has kind of dipped into that costume cupboard once more. It's a 50 years apart in New York. So there's a story about a girl in 1927 who's deaf, and she kind of goes into the big city for an adventure to find her dad. And in 1977, a kid from Minnesota is struck deaf by lightning, and he comes to the town to New York to kind of seek his mother. Do the two stories kind of combine? It becomes a kind of, you know, hijinks and escapades in the city kind of story, like Twice. One's in black and white and one's in sort of big funky US kind of street style kind of colors with sort of, you know, jazz funk on the soundtrack with a Norman Whitfield there. It's bright, it's exciting, it's very sweet. It might be the artiest kids movie ever made. I didn't really know who was it quite for, but it was absolutely charming. It's based on a book by Brian Selznick, whose previous work was Hugo, which was adapted by Martin Scorsese's the movie. So it's got that storybook kind of magic feel to it. I have to say, it kind of teeters on the edge of twee and quirky, a little bit too much for me, but there is real emotion running for it, which pulls it back and makes it kind of a very charming and rather lovely experience, and it looks great.
Well, Jason, we've talked about two of the bigger films then. Tell us about this rather smaller film, just finally, the Russian film Loveless.
Yeah, I think Cannes got its real first Palme d'Or heavyweight contender in a Russian film called Loveless by a filmmaker who I really respect called Alexandry Zviagintsev. He's brilliant. He did Leviathan a couple of years ago here in Cannes, which I think is one of the great films of the century. This one is called Loveless. It's a bleak and bitter, chillingly grim portrait of societal breakdown in Russia. I know you really fancy it now, don't you, Ben? But it is absolutely brilliant. We see a sort of couple breaking up and warring and divorcing, and then their child disappears, caught in between the sort of cracks of their relationship. He literally disappears, sparking a sort of search, and we get to see this industrial town where he lives in all its details. Everyone's searching for this kid all around in the forest, in supermarkets, in hotels. It's a film about property and new money. And in the background, there's a sort of radio reports chuntering about the war in Ukraine, the war in Syria, political scandals. It's a scathing portrait of how loveless a society modern Russia has become. And I thought it was absolutely brilliant. If it wins the Palme d'Or, I wouldn't be surprised and I wouldn't be disappointed.
Jason Solomon's in Cannes. We've spoken to two of the members of this year's feature film jury. Paolo Sorrentino was featured on our Italian special, which we recorded on location at Rome's Cinecittà Film Studios. That was episode number 26. And Park Chan-wook told us about his latest film, The Handmaiden. That was episode 47. Still to come, we'll discuss the three-year rule at the centre of that Netflix debate in Cannes, and we'll work out why Warner Brothers' new film, King Arthur, has become such a disaster. Stay tuned. The winning film at Cannes in 1964 was the romantic musical The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, directed by Jacques Demy, starring Catherine Deneuve. The jury president that year was the legendary director Fritz Lang, fresh from a spot playing himself in Jean-Luc Godard's Le Mépris. The following year saw Cannes welcome its first ever female jury president, with the Hollywood actress Olivia de Havilland. In 1966, the festival was again presided over a female president, thanks to the Italian actress Sophia Loren. The opening film that year perhaps fit with what we've come to expect from the category today. Modesty Blaze is recalled mostly fondly as a camp classic. Other legends who have taken the presidential chair include Italian director Luchino Visconti in 1969, Ingrid Bergman in 1973, and Kirk Douglas in 1980. Get yourself into a Cannes state of mind with MUBI, the curated movie site of cult, classic, and award-winning films. And among the attractions showing right now is the Italian film Dear Diary, which scored a Best Actor award at the festival in 1993, and the 2012 French drama Alia, part of the Director's Fortnight selection. Sample a whole month of movies for free right now. Head over to MUBI.com/monocle. That's, of course, MUBI/monocle. This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. Now, some purists insist that cinema is strictly something to be experienced in an actual cinema. Anything less is merely a movie. As the former manager of Melbourne's Astor Theatre once told me, claiming to have seen Gone with the Wind after watching it on television is a little bit like viewing the Mona Lisa via a souvenir postcard. But in the age of streaming and binge-watching television, have times changed? Well, with me to jump into the weeds on this and a couple of other topics today are the former fashion editor Brian Lewandowski and Monocle's own entertainment expert Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Welcome both. Now, before we jump into this, let's hear a bit of what Cannes Festival director Thierry Frémaux had to say about Netflix being allowed to compete.
Cannes is a film festival in theatres, and for the territory of France, we would like to have all the film competing in Cannes available in theatres. It's not, of course, against anyone. It's not to fight against anyone. It's just to say, well, we hear.
Fernando, what is Netflix doing at Cannes?
I believe this year they have two films in competition, but according to the new rules they want to implement, I don't think this would be possible. The Cannes, you know, organizers, they're against, you know, the Netflix way of doing things. So I think Netflix even proposed that they could do like a kind of a limited release on cinema, but of course they have the same day release on their streaming services, and I think they are against that. They say you should be in the cinema first and then go to streaming. And I think France is quite a specific example as well, because I think usually it takes like 3 years or so for a film to be allowed to be on streaming.
Well, that's right.
There's very strict regulations there, actually.
Yes, and from what I understand, all of that's what's really at the heart of all this. It's referred to as the French cultural exception, which is apparently a law that says a certain percentage of all the box office and DVD streaming and so on revenues, they all need to go into financing some homegrown films coming from France. And it also dictates that 36-month delay, Fernando, that you just alluded to there, between theatrical releases and streaming dates. And of course, Netflix didn't want to be part of that. And Amazon, indeed, another streaming service, has decided it's completely fine. We're going to release our movies into cinemas, and they'll be actual movies. Brian, I think a lot of people today kind of just view these as one and the same, don't they? That whether a film was released on Netflix or if it's released in cinemas, a lot of people don't really see that much of a difference when it comes to the prestige, perhaps.
I definitely agree. I mean, I love the cinema myself, and it warms my heart when I go to a neighborhood and see they still have an indie cinema running, or when you have these revamped indie cinemas. I think cinema is so important. The big screen, the premiere, the release, there's so much glamour there. I completely get it. I empathize with, you know, the standpoints behind these laws. But I don't think it's a lack of prestige. I think it's just a huge sign of how our changing culture views entertainment. The lines between cinema, television, online media, it's very blurred. Think of what we're watching today. We can all be watching the same show, but how we watch it depends on our own lifestyle. The same episode of some new show, you can watch on the way to work, I can watch at work, and you can watch it at night on your TV. And there are, you know, very many legal ways to do this that are offered to us. I don't think that cuts down in the prestige of entertainment or the quality of what we're watching. I think, if anything, it kind of helps bring a more diverse selection of different types of media and entertainment to different people. Sort of like what Will Smith said in his quote.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's perhaps where the culture clash that we're looking at here is coming from, Fernando, because it does seem strange. I mean, sure, we can all exist in this, you know, cohabiting world where we've got online and we've got cinemas and we can all go and experience both, as Will Smith was saying. But as the director, the legendary filmmaker Pedro Almodovar was saying, this is Cannes. You know, that's fine for that world to exist, but this is Cannes. We don't necessarily need to embrace that.
I have to be honest, I kind of actually agree with the organizers of Cannes Film Festival. And it's nothing against Netflix. I think, you know, it's their own festival. They are allowed to choose which type of companies or which type of films they have. And clearly, you know, in France, you know, I think France is like this not only with film, but with all other fields in some ways. And the cinema owners are worried. I understand why they're worried, because people, of course, I'm not saying if you watch Netflix, you still go to the cinema. But I think people are going less to the cinema, perhaps, because of Netflix. And of course, they feel threatened. And I don't know how it will affect them financially in some ways. I think they're right. It's their own festival. I think Netflix will still do very well. And they can go to other festivals.
Well, jumping right down to the other end of the spectrum now, an entire industry exists around the concept of researching and analysing markets ahead of a big budget film being greenlit. And yet, despite those enormous resources, the big studios still manage to get it wrong with remarkable regularity. And the latest example of that is King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which, with a budget of about $175 million, limped home after its opening weekend with just under $50 million. Across 51 international markets. Brian, what do you think went wrong here?
Well, I saw the signs for the film on the tube walls, and it was only about maybe 3 weeks ago when I first started seeing them. This is coming out of nowhere. This is Guy Ritchie. This is Jude Law.
I had the exact same reaction. It did seem to just pop up out of nowhere, and that does happen every now and then. Sometimes it's a bit of a nice surprise, but most of the time, it does strike me as a little bit concerning.
It did, and it sort of opened a whole chest of whys for me. I'm thinking also like King Arthur, really. You know, this article made sort of other references to Ben-Hur, to these other films that are getting these revamps.
Yes, I think people, they're generally not very interested in seeing another King Arthur film. In fact, in the article they mentioned, I think the last time they did the film from 2004 was also a flop.
Not even that long ago, is it?
Exactly. So, and I think this kind of Swords and Sandals type of film, they're just not finding its audience in the cinema. So, and it was not the first one, as you mentioned, Ben-Hur, another huge flop. And I can't believe they approved this project. $175 million, and I'm not even sure that they will get back just the money. So.
No, it looks as though they won't even break even, and it's even more remarkable when you put it in the context of what Warner Brothers was actually intending for this. It was supposed to be the start of a multi-film shared universe, sort of like Marvel's Avengers series.
Keep dreaming.
Well, exactly. When you think of how large the vision was for this, production, of course, was stalled. A number of actors filtered through the project as it was stalled. Idris Elba, James McAvoy, Colin Farrell all said no. And Guy Ritchie wasn't even the original director for this. So it feels as though this is wound up as a bit of a tapestry of half-started projects over a number of years. Let's move along, because we need to talk about another king today, a much larger one and a much hairier one as well. Since first appearing in the classic 1933 epic King Kong, he's been popping up in various media for about 85 years. So the giant ape is now making the leap to Broadway in a show that originally premiered in Melbourne, but way back in 2010. I was actually living in Melbourne at the time, and as I recall it, the local reaction was mixed, to put it politely, though let's be clear that this is actually the creation of an animatronics company. So the idea here is that it's meant to be a big stage arena spectacular, not necessarily evoking the 1930s New York elegance of the original film. It does strike me, however, that the reaction in Melbourne was not good. People were not viewing this as a big stage spectacular as had been intended. Can it appeal to American audiences? Because, Brian, you're a New Yorker yourself, and you would know better than most that New Yorkers can be pretty prickly when it comes to things like this.
Absolutely. You're going to have this very discerning eye when it comes to musicals by New Yorkers, but then you'll also have this very broad eye with, you know, the huge amount of tourists that come in. They are the ones who want to see Shrek and Legally Blonde and all of these other film-to-stage musicals.
Because they're all very, very familiar. They've all seen them before. So, you know, it's not challenging to walk into a theater and know kind of what you're going to get.
Sure. The other thing is, too, I am a huge fan of musicals, and I always have been. And as a child, one thing I loved about musicals is how exclusive and rare they felt. You've got shows like Les Mis and Phantom of the Opera that are, you know, huge classics, huge stage blockbusters, and they're based on books. You've got so many other rare, great musicals, even more contemporary ones like Wicked, based on books. And the quality that these have is just pure originality. You don't know what to expect. I mean, sure, you could have read the book, but it's going to be completely reimagined through characters. You've never seen this character acted out anywhere but in your head if you've read the book. On stage, it's brand new for you. Whereas the film, you're always going to have a first impression. And it just causes you to ask, why? Why does this need to be made into a musical? It is great in its many iterations on film. And you can ask that question for a huge amount nowadays of musicals that are based on films.
In this case, I wouldn't even say the remakes of King Kong have actually been great, because you only ever turn back to the 1933 one. No one really even looks back at the Peter Jackson version with any great romance either. And Fernando, I know we just had Kong Skull Island,
yes,
that just hit cinemas, and I know you wandered over to see that and were not very happy.
I was not impressed. I it was supposed to be a fun B-movie, which I love this kind of things, but I mean, again, the script was pretty bad.
And we should offer a disclaimer that Fernando is a very, very big fan of big multiplex epic fare. You love the Jurassic Parks of the world.
I love it. I love Jurassic World. I think it was an excellent film, but I think people are having a little bit of a King Kong fatigue as well, so I smell a flop. Again, of course, it's not as bad as King Arthur, because I think King Kong, I mean, he's, you know, the Skull Island, okay, didn't do extremely well, but it was not bad overall in the box office. So I think, you know, people might go and watch just because they're curious. But I wonder if this is not going to be like a new Spider-Man, the Broadway version, which was a terrible flop as well. And I don't know how much is it going to cost. I think, you know, to have a big King Kong on stage, that's costly.
Well, it will be fairly costly because it's opening at the 1,700-seat Broadway Theatre, which is currently hosting Miss Saigon. It does have music in it by the Australian writer Eddie Perfect, who is quite a respected talent over in Australia. So perhaps there is the capacity there for things to be looking up. Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Brian Lewandowski, thank you.
Miss Martha!
Girls, we all need to help. Quickly, he's losing blood.
I pray that the Lord see fit to restore the health of the wounded soldier.
We ask for your protection over our school, and we pray that we will be kept from harm throughout the night.
Amen. Nicole Kidman has no less than 4 projects at Cannes this year. One of them is the much-anticipated new film from Sofia Coppola, The Beguiled. That's among the films we'll be discussing next week. Today's show was mixed and edited by Kieran Matthew Banerjee and researched by Yolin Goffan. The Cinema Show returns next week. I'm Ben Rylan. We'll catch you then.